WHO.FM. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Joe Clement. The Old Mole Variety Hour takes its name from a term that Karl Marx used to describe the forces of revolution, that worthy pioneer that grubs, burrows, digs, undermines, agitates, and will someday root down the mountain of capitalism that threatens to bury us all. It's no accident that the Old Mole Variety Hour is hosted on KBOO-FM Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio station where small-d democracy lives. If any listeners to The Mole are not yet members of KBOO, you can join by going to the website at kboo.fm and clicking on the Donate button in the upper right corner. Today is Memorial Day, and Barack Obama recently became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Japanese city of Hiroshima since U.S. warplanes dropped the first atomic bomb there on August 6, 1945. Hundreds of thousands died, and casualties of the radiation continue. Speaking at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park, Obama offered no apology for the bombings, but called for a world without nuclear weapons. Despite that call, the United States has been quietly upgrading its nuclear arsenal to create smaller, more precise nuclear bombs as part of a massive effort that will cost up to $1 trillion over 3 decades. Democracy Now! Last week featured an interview with Hiroshima survivor and anti-nuclear activist Setsuko Thurlow, who commented on the $1 trillion investment in modernizing nuclear weapons and delivery systems, quote, $1 trillion. What can we do with that money for schools, hospitals, and community services, and so on? We've been depriving people's daily lives in order to waste the money to make armaments to kill masses of people. This is just simply insanity. And it pains me. It pains many other survivors who survived, because we've been recording our painful story to tell the world as a warning about the danger of nuclear weapons. I want the world to wake up to the reality of this totally unacceptable reality. Today, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we offer 3 conversations in honor of Memorial Day, dedicated to remembering the past and learning from it, to remembering those fallen in the wars that the U.S. has waged against other nations and against people right here, and to honoring those who seek to wake us up and change our reality, to find another way to live through action, activism, and creativity. First on today's show, Desiree Hellegers interviews S. Brian Wilson, peace activist and veteran of the American War in Vietnam, author of the book Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson, and the focus of a new documentary, Paying the Price for Peace. Then, Bill Resnick talks with Brian Terrell, who is co-coordinator for Voices for Creative Nonviolence and lives on a Catholic worker farm in Molloy, Iowa. Brian works on ending violence as a solution to human problems. They'll be discussing drones, the new drone warfare, and creative nonviolent resistance. Finally, we turn to the war on Black lives and the work of resistance to that. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will be here to pay tribute to Sandra Bland, the 28-year-old Black woman who was found hanged in a jail cell in Waller County, Texas, after being arrested during a traffic stop. Bland was part of the Black Lives Matter movement, including through her video activism. Mike and Jan discuss her life and work and the complicated ways that the personal and political intersect in the lives of activists. As always, you'll be able to find links to more information about these pieces on our KBOO web space in a day or two at kboo.fm/program/old-mole-variety-hour. That page now also features a handy link that says subscribe to podcast. And if you do, you'll find shows and individual segments magically appearing in your podcast feed. Let us know if you'd like to get involved with the Old Mole Variety Hour, or if you have comments, questions, kudos, or complaints, by emailing us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com or by contacting us through the comments section of any of our pages on the KBOO website. You can also like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We turn now to the conversation between Desiree Hellegers and S. Brian Wilson.
Peace activist, attorney, and writer S. Brian Wilson served as a first lieutenant in Vietnam, where as commander of a U.S. Air Force Combat Security Police Unit in Vietnam's Mekong Delta in 1969, he was charged with documenting the aftermath of the bombings of 5 Vietnamese fishing villages. Transformed by the experience, he became a peace activist. On September 1, 1987, during a nonviolent blockade of trains headed for the Concord Naval Weapons Station, which supplied weapons for the Contras in Nicaragua, a train accelerated, striking Wilson and severing both of his legs. In the aftermath of the accident, thousands of peace activists descended on the scene, ripping the rails out of the ground and creating an encampment that lasted for 2.5 years. Brian Wilson is the author of the book Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson, and the subject of a new documentary, Paying the Price for Peace, which debuts in Portland on July 3rd. This spring, he returned to Vietnam for the first time. His Memorial Day reflection, entitled Remembering All the Deaths from All of the Wars, appeared in Counterpunch on May 27th. I interviewed him on Friday in the Portland home that he shares with activist Becky Lunning.
On April 13th, I think, in 1969, when I went to the first target I was asked to assess, it was a village, at least 100, 150 people. And they're all killed. They're all dead.
Brian spoke of the scene he encountered in another of the five villages he visited in the aftermath of American bombings. Among the hundreds of dead bodies, one woman in particular stood out.
Any further, I looked down, and she was holding three children, I think. They'd all just been bombed within the hour, all napalmed. But her eyes were open, and I was struck by looking at her eyes. She was just a young mother. It was very, very blackened and bloodied, but I could see her face, and when I saw her eyes, all I could think of was I was looking at my sister. It wasn't a thought either. It was like, my God, I'm looking at my sister who's dead. And it was like there was no distance between it. It was like we were like family. I can't tell you why that happened, but it's what happened to me. I was with a Vietnamese lieutenant who was laughing. But he was, you know, his family had been part of the French oligarchic structure in Vietnam, and he was now in the South Vietnamese.
And, we know there were other American soldiers who had similar responses, yeah.
So I was, but I had an epiphany in that moment. It was like, wow, what the f*** am I doing? I'm in her village. She is not in my village. And, there was just piles of bodies everywhere. But it was just that I saw her eyes. The napalm had burned her eyelids off. So that's why her eyes were open. She was like, and she was on her back looking up. And I was just struck. I was actually crying. And I think I was throwing up bile juice. It was, I was just, and I had a handkerchief over my face because the smell was so bad from the burning flesh and the lingering napalm in the air and the chemical residue of bombs. I don't know, but it was really pungent. But in that moment, it was like a lightning bolt cut my paradigm, or it was like a guillotine just snapped off my paradigm, just like that. It was gone. Soon, I realized, we're targeting villages to get body counts. And I was devastated by it. Although once I understood it was intentional, I was sickened by it. But I also said I was suicidal for a short period because I just couldn't comprehend the evil, the nature of it. But then I, with my lawyer's mind, because I was almost a lawyer when I was drafted, I had to get to the bottom of it. So I did. I spent quite a bit of time trying to figure out what's going on. And I met with the intelligence officers in Saigon, at Sansanut, that were in my unit. And after meeting with them for several hours and going over bombing reports and sharing with them what I'd witnessed personally in five different areas, we concluded, this is all intentional to get body counts. And even though that was a devastating conclusion, I was relieved to know that I had an answer. I had, for me, as a kind of a budding lawyer mind, I had an explanation that enabled me to then become anti-war.
So it didn't matter whose bodies they were.
No, but they were these are undefended fishing villages, and most of the bodies were children. Clearly not soldiers or fighters at night. The fathers might have been. But, just the whole idea. And I hadn't quite figured out yet that we had invaded the country and were illegally. I hadn't quite gotten to that point for another couple months. While I was there, I realized, man, we had just completely illegally, unconscionably invaded a country and are occupying it. But I didn't know that in April. I didn't have that 30. I mean, and if you say that today to most Vienna vets, they would not even, they would never even agree with that. They wouldn't even conceive of that. They couldn't grasp it. I didn't know anybody else that had witnessed what I'd witnessed in the aftermath of a bombing, and that within an hour after the bombing. But there was plenty of Marines and Army guys that were, of course, going into villages and killing people. That just wasn't my experience. But to me, it was so overwhelmingly sickening. So it was kind of obvious in a way. If I could get over my belief in America, which I did pretty fast, but that's a hard one because your whole life you're taught from your church, your parents, your school, your political leaders, the media, that America's, you know, a phenomenally wonderful nation in the history of the world. And then to start thinking, you know, it might be just the opposite. And I did tell my commander, you know, when he left, he was a colonel. I was a lieutenant, and I was ordered home early because I was speaking out against the war. I said, I reminded my colonel boss that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence in which he used the words merciless Indian savages. It's in the Declaration of Independence. And I said, I know who the savages are. And it wasn't the Indians. I mean, that's how, it's like, we're the savages. And then that led many years later to me studying Jung and Hillman, studying archetypes, and we project our demons on others, and we just completely emasculate any concept of veracity in our own minds because we're just constantly looking for a demon because we can't deal with the demon in us. We killed the Indians and stole their land. Can't deal with it. I mean, it's just too shameful. So I felt really ashamed that I'd been part of this whole operation in Vietnam. I started reading. Oh, man, I became such a voracious reader of history and the war and history of Vietnam. And I discovered within a year after I got out, after I got back, it was about the time I actually got out of the military, that there were a lot of mutinies in the Army in 69. I didn't know that. And none of it was organized. It wasn't centrally organized or coordinated. It was like a ripe moment that was spontaneous, like a rhizomes, sprouting because it was a ripe moment in history because more and more soldiers are realizing the insanity of it all and why are they being put into harm's way for a lie or, you know, for something that's immoral or something they just can't comprehend or whatever. So it was, I think there were several dozen mutinies in 69. I didn't know they were happening. And I don't know that any of the units knew that the other units were mutinying. But by 1970 and 71, the Army was totally undependable.
Brian read from his article that appeared in Counterpunch magazine on May 27th.
I'm staggered by the amount of firepower the U.S. used and the incredible death and destruction it caused on an innocent people. Here are some statistics. 75% of South Vietnam was considered a free fire zone. I call that a genocidal zone. Anything could be killed in those zones. And we did pretty much not feel restricted. Over 6 million Southeast Asians killed. That includes Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Over 64,000 U.S. and Allied soldiers killed. Over 1,600 U.S. soldiers and 300,000 Vietnamese soldiers remain missing. Thousands of amputees, paraplegic, blind, deaf, and other maimings created. 13,000 of 21,000 Vietnamese villages. 62% of all our villages, that's north and south, were severely damaged or destroyed, mostly by bombing. And again, there was no north and south, really, of Vietnam. It was created by the U.S. It was actually created by the Geneva Accords in 1954 that were going to lead to elections in the area south of the DMZ and north of the DMZ. And those elections were never held because we discovered that Ho Chi Minh would have been elected, and that was not acceptable. So when I say all 13,000 villages north and south, 13,000 Vietnamese villages were destroyed. That includes everything from the top of the north, at the north end of the country, to the very tip of the south. Nearly 950 churches and pagodas destroyed by bombing. 350 hospitals. 1,500 maternity wards destroyed by bombing. 3,000 high schools and universities destroyed by bombing. 15,000 bridges destroyed by bombing. 10 million cubic meters of dikes destroyed by bombing. Over 3,700 U.S. fixed-wing aircraft were shot down. Then there were 36 million U.S. helicopter sorties during the war. And 10,000 of those helicopters were lost or severely damaged. 26 million bomb craters were created, majority from B-52s. 39 million acres of land in Indochina, or 91% of the land area of South Vietnam, littered with fragments of bombs and shells. That's equivalent to 244,160-acre farms, or an area the size of all of New England, except Connecticut.
That is littered with unexploded ordnance. And a member of one of the UXO disposal teams from Quan Tri was just killed last week. Trying to disarm a bomb. The first one in the history of Project Renew.
Yeah. 21 million gallons of extremely poisonous chemicals in the form of herbicides were applied in 20,000 chemical spraying missions between 1961 and 1970. As many as 4.8 million Vietnamese living in nearly 3,200 villages were directly sprayed by the chemicals. That was 24% of South Vietnam area was sprayed.
Dude, do you want to talk a little bit about what you encountered? It sounds like you were in Quan Tri, which was, I think, the most heavily sprayed region within Vietnam.
It was, of course, the DMZ, basically.
Mm-hmm. So what did you witness 41 years now after the war on your trip in April?
Well, you never know it had been destroyed, really, by bombings, because it's all built up again. And we were told, wherever we were driving in Quan Tri, we were told there was nothing left here. Most of the trees were gone, and all the buildings were gone. And now you'd never know that, because we did go into the tunnels that are in the DMZ. These are not the Coochie tunnels, but they're tunnels in Quan Tri. And there were, on the north side of the DMZ, which was 6 miles wide, there were, I think, I remember being briefed, there were 144 villages that had been totally destroyed, and they all survived by living in underground tunnels. It was just amazing. The resilience and the ingenuity and the tenacity and the determination of the Vietnamese to not surrender, to not give up. And many of them were malnourished. They didn't have much food, and they dug all those tunnels by hand, with hand tools, with little buckets, carrying the dirt out. Up to the top, and they had to conceal even the piles of dirt so they couldn't be seen by reconnaissance photos. So we went to three large orphanages, including the Friendship Village, and we saw hundreds of third-generation birth defect children.
I think most Americans don't understand that that Agent Orange has these intergenerational effects.
I broke down. I was crying. I just... You know, it's too much. Seeing all these kids knowing that my country is responsible for it, and they never acknowledged it, they won't pay for it. Over 500,000 Vietnamese have died from chronic conditions related to spraying, and an estimated 650,000 are still suffering from those conditions. And there's at least 500,000 children that have been born with Agent Orange-induced birth defects, and we saw them everywhere. There were 375,000 tons of napalm dropped. We also had these huge Rome plows, these big caterpillar bulldozers with huge blades that destroyed an area the size of Rhode Island, scraped everything bare.
Which is another reason to boycott Caterpillar.
Hello.
Unfortunately, the Portland City Human Rights Commission has requested that the city council boycott them because of their involvement in the Gaza
occupied territories in Palestine. Yeah.
As many as 36 million total tons of ordnance was expended from aerial and naval bombing, artillery, and ground combat firepower. 150,000 to 300,000 tons of unexploded ordnance remains scattered around Southeast Asia, mostly in South Vietnam. 40,000 have been killed in Vietnam since the end of the war. Of Southeast Asian dead on the Vietnam Wall in Washington, it would be over 9 miles long, or nearly 100 times its current 493-foot length. So, on Memorial Day, how can you memorialize U.S. casualties without memorializing all those casualties in Southeast Asia? Otherwise, we're just memorializing war. U.S. wars. And so I cannot even think about Memorial Day unless I'm thinking about all the victims of our war. And yes, some of our soldiers fought heroically and under the miserable conditions. So, okay, we honor our soldiers. But if we're going to honor our soldiers, we have to honor all those people that our soldiers killed. Otherwise, it is meaningless to me.
And how do we honor them?
Well, we honor them by, in my view, I thought that President Obama had an opportunity to revive the notion that we owe Vietnam billions of reparations, which Nixon promised, that we owe the Vietnam all the support they need for removing unexploded ordnance.
No strings attached.
No strings attached, none whatsoever. And we owe them billions of dollars in aid to help with all these Agent Orange victims, of which there are, you know, hundreds of thousands. And when you look at those birth defect children and knowing that those chemicals cause that genetic damage, and we have never acknowledged it and are not paying for their care or their rehab or their, you know, anything for them. It's just disgusting. So that would be a way of honoring the Vietnamese victims.
You've been listening to an interview with S. Brian Wilson, who's the subject of a new documentary called Paying the Price for Peace, which will debut in Portland on July 3rd. You can look for more information on the Old Mole Variety Hour website on KBOO. We'll also be posting an extended version of this interview with S. Brian Wilson. This has been Desiree Hellegers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. You've just heard some of Black Sabbath doing War Pigs. And before that, Desiree Hellegers talking with peace activist and veteran S. Brian Wilson. Later on today's show, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will be talking about the life and work of Sandra Bland. Up next, we hear from Bill Resnick in conversation with Brian Terrell about creative nonviolence in addressing the new drone warfare.
Hi, Brian Terrell. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Brian Terrell is a co-coordinator for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. He lives on a Catholic worker farm in Molloy, Iowa. commutes to Chicago often, where their national office is. He's worked on the front lines of the struggles to end violence as a solution to human problems, whether it be the death penalty or war itself, or in fact drone warfare, where he's been arrested and jailed several times in the last 10 years or so. Brian Terrell, tell us about the U.S. drone program and your life work in Voices for Creative Nonviolence in trying to challenge and expose and stop drone warfare.
Well, I think one thing I have to say is that the organization that I work with, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, had already been sending delegations to Afghanistan to meet Afghan people and to talk to people who were affected by our war and just to try to get to know them. And so my first trip to Afghanistan was in 2009, right as the protests were beginning about drones, and we were Americans just beginning to be aware of them. And I think this is one reason why Voices has been one of the organizations in the forefront of protesting against the drones is that while many Americans first heard of them as kind of a nifty new weapon, cleaner, easier warfare, we were hearing about the drones from the victims in Afghanistan, from people who in Kabul who are refugees from various far reaches of the country, who talking about their fear of this weapon and beating families that have been torn apart. I met a young girl who not only lost her parents but lost an arm in a drone strike. So this is a very real issue to us. It's not abstract.
You've written that drone warfare, it's not just the CIA assassinating nefarious figures that they've somehow done surveillance on for a long time, that whole story. But it's really the U.S. Air Force is involved, and they're doing all the killing. And they're not only assassinating people, they're involved in all sorts of surveillance and attacks in many countries.
Yeah, that's something that we had always wondered about. And about a year ago, some of the former drone operators who've been speaking out admitted that while they were working as airmen in the United States Air Force, they were actually, Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, they were actually taking orders from the CIA, which is the way one of the drone operators put it, was the CIA was the customer and the Air Force the contractor. Just one more layer of all the many illegalities of this is that having soldiers taking orders from people that are outside what's supposed to be a fairly transparent chain of command. The word warfare, we use it, but this is almost not war anymore. It's taken us into another sphere. Assassinations have gone on, these targeting killings, for a long time, but we haven't been able to do it, around the clock with hundreds of drones in the air at any moment. So we're looking for people. Sometimes we know their names, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes it's by the way they're behaving. Somebody sitting in an office in Nevada or in Iowa or New York State is looking at a screen and seeing a behavior that looks like to them like it's the behavior of a terrorist, and they are not being killed when they're actually being involved in combat, often very far away. Just a few days ago, the Mullah Mansour, the head of the Taliban, was killed by a drone strike. It's being very celebrated today. But the strike was in Pakistan. It was far away from a battlefield. This person was not an imminent threat to the United States, although the United States now says imminent does not mean that anyone's suspected of being involved with any particular action at all at any time, but just that they may be at some point. But he was killed as the taxi he was in was going down a public highway, hit by a Hellfire missile, and the man who was unlucky enough to be driving the taxi, who was just a taxi driver, was killed as well. And, of course, the Pakistani government is protesting this. It's a crime, no matter what you think that somebody has done. You just can't shoot a missile and kill them while they're driving down the street, whatever you think they might be going to do. In this case, it looks like they got the guy that they said they did, but very, very often they don't on the first try or the second or the third. It's killing a lot of people who are, whether they mean us harm or not, they're being killed in these nefarious attacks that have no legal justification. The politest word is assassination, but they're murders.
I just saw a recent film, Eye in the Sky. It explores the issue of drone warfare. It's a very gripping suspense film. Will they or will they not kill an adorable little girl selling bread for her mother? But she's selling bread right next to a armed compound in which several terrorists are putting on their suicide bomber vests. it concentrates on the killing of innocents and calling it collateral damage, but it argues that it's justified by saving more lives from terrorist attacks. But as you point out, most of these drone attacks, it's not at all clear there's going to be a terrorist attack as a result of whatever is happening. There's no smoking gun. There's no way of being certain that you're saving anybody. You know, it's very much like, you know, the justification for torture, where they say, well, we have to torture people to get this information because their compatriots are just about ready to set off bombs to kill hundreds and thousands of people. But that's almost never the case where they're actually saving any lives. They think they might be, but that situation never occurs.
No, that really is false. It is the evidence, like one thing we're finding out now, some leaks, is that the drones work as cell towers. They can monitor traffic from somebody's cell phone. They can identify somebody's SIM card. It's the same way that Facebook finds out what to advertise, on your Facebook page. They're using the same technology to see the traffic through someone's cell phone to decide that the people they're meeting with and the people that they're talking to, that they will meet a profile. And even though apparently the government, the CIA, and the military knows that this is a very, very unreliable way of finding out who a potential threat is, they're still using it.
Yeah, often a lot of the information they get also from their informants is completely false, and it's just settling disputes and by local people who want other people killed. They're killing tremendous numbers of people that way, it seems to me. Many of them are completely innocent, and others, it's not at all clear that they actually present a threat. But they justify it based on this ideal, as they justify torture, as the U.S. justified lots of things. We're saving your lives.
It's not doing that. We just had the latest one was just last July. Is a man, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who was Obama's top military intelligence official, on his retirement, he said about the drones, when you drop a bomb from a drone, you're going to cause more damage than you're going to cause good. Other people from Robert Gates, who was the defense secretary for many years, has said that these are causing more enemies than we're killing. General Stanley McChrystal said the danger, he said this is a quote, and then there's that part of the perception of arrogance, the perception of helpless people in an area being shot at like thunderbolts from the sky by an entity acting as though they have omniscience and omnipotence. And you can create a tremendous amount of resentment within populations, even the people that are not themselves targeted. With these strikes, the question among all these CIA and military and diplomatic people who've retired is, with a drone strike and you kill somebody, are you creating 10 new enemies or 40 new enemies? That seems to be the only real issue, the only real disagreement among a lot of these experts, people who are, you know, until recently very highly placed in the government and in this administration.
Yeah, it seems to me they also ignore in their drone warfare almost all of the really important questions that are in some ways just functional questions or questions of what's happening to these troops who are in fact doing it. What's happening to the society? It's the same question of the use of the death penalty. We know it doesn't really deter murder, but does this assertion of state power to kill people in fact empower other people who do want to murder? Does it so cheapen the society and make murder into another functional act that some people feel justified in doing it?
There's one very disturbing thing happening in the so-called war on terror is in various fronts is there's more and more hospitals being destroyed. Both sides. But by not, you can't say both sides because there's not two. But by several of the different actors, the Syrian rebels have been accused of bombing hospitals. The Saudis have been accused of bombing hospitals. The United States, of course, the hospital in Kunduz. But I think what happened, especially in Kunduz, where the United States did it, is, although that was not a drone strike, when you get to the point where you can kill an enemy off the battlefield just because you think that they might be an enemy, so this hospital run by Doctors Without Borders is treating members of the Taliban who are wounded, who are, of course, under international protection. If you can kill Mullah Mansour when he's in his car driving down the highway, such as just happened, when that's justifiable, what about when your potential enemy is somebody sitting in a hospital bed? I think this is what you're talking about, Bill. There's a degradation of the respect for human life. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, it also, it seems to me, when the U.S. does it, like torture, the precedent is being set in terms of drones or torture or use of atomic weapons. It legitimates the actions, and the U.S. is way in the lead in legitimating the cruelest, most murderous, most arbitrary kinds of action using state power. Ultimately, that the blowback on that is enormous.
Another way that blowback can happen, and I think we should be, unfortunately, should be expecting it, is just last month, the U.S. Air Force Command said that they are going to, this has been controversial for a while, but they're going to count the time that drone operators are spent flying their drones. That's going to be counted in their records as combat time, combat pay, and for promotions and medals and things. So they're in combat, but they're physically in my home state, Iowa, the National Guard at the civilian airport in Des Moines. There's a building where the Iowa Air National Guard is flying Predator drones over Afghanistan and Yemen and wherever else. Those men and women are counted as combatants, which of course they are. They're engaged in battle. They're not training. They're not doing maneuvers. They're actually involved every day in battle, but they're in Des Moines. And this is happening all over the country. Even though they're not in any physical danger, but what's happening is that these are combatants, and a place where combatants are in combat is a combat zone. So by any measure of international law, before this administration started messing with the definitions, Mullah Mansour, however bad he might be, when he was in his taxi going down the highway in Pakistan, he was, by international law, a protected person. And to kill him is a crime because he's not a combatant. But when you have an Air National Guard member in Des Moines, Iowa, sitting at a computer, and they are actually involved in combat, and their own command recognizes them as combatants, that attack, an attack on that person, would be a legitimate act of war. I'm speaking as a pacifist who can't stand the idea of war being legitimate. But if there's any legitimacy, it would be there. And those airmen are sitting in the middle of a civilian airport that's surrounded by residential neighborhoods. So they're supposed to be protecting us, but what it's doing is it's bringing a real war zone into the middle of the United States, into families and schools and homes and waterworks and everything. And it's a very, very dangerous thing.
Well, also, if everybody becomes a combatant somehow, then, of course, the farmers who are growing food that feeds the military become combatants, and it becomes legitimate to kill almost everybody. I hate to say it, it seems to me that the Israelis somehow have perfected those notions, so they really are trying to wipe out the infrastructure of Gaza and the civilian infrastructure that is used by the, quote, terrorists, although many of them, of course, aren't, but by also the civilians. That it seems to me the slippery slope, it's really dangerous, and it's also absolutely unnecessary, which we didn't talk about today. There are ways of, in fact, creating a semi-civilized world without using warfare. That's the other side of the story we should talk about, but we don't have time, Brian Terrell.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for talking to us, and keep up the good work.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Here comes the helicopter, second time today. Everybody scatters and hopes it goes away. How many kids they've murdered, only God can say.
That is Bruce Cockburn doing If I Had a Rocket Launcher, although that would not be a nonviolent response. And before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Brian Terrell talking about drone warfare and creative nonviolence. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO-FM Portland, and I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. You can find more about Brian's group, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, by visiting their website. And as always, you can find relevant links and other information for individual segments in a day or two by visiting our site at kboo.fm/program/old-mole-variety-hour. Last today, we turned to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for a discussion of the life and work of Sandra Bland. And we're going to introduce their conversation by listening to about a minute from Bland's last activist video.
Good morning, my beautiful kings and queens. It is Friday, April 10th, 2015. It's kind of chilly out here this morning, so hopefully you bundled up. Kings and queens, someone proposed me with the question the other day, and I'm a little stuck on it. I was asked, was I trying to racially unite or racially incite? Well, honestly, I feel that my goal is to racially unite. Now, in the process of doing that, some people will be incited, i.e. upset, because based on the history of America, it is not good when it comes to black and white people. But I want us to try and get past that. And that is ultimately impossible. It's impossible to happen until certain people realize they were born into a certain type of privilege. And it does not matter if you never break a law, if you never get into any trouble. Part of the reason for that being is the police don't even suspect you of doing anything wrong. And that's just how it is.
That was a clip from a video by Sandra Bland, the 28-year-old black woman who was found hanged in a jail cell in Waller County, Texas, on July 13, 2015, after being arrested for a minor traffic incident. At the time she was arrested, she had just returned to the town in Texas where she had graduated from college and was expecting to start a new job soon. In the year before her death, she had become active in the Black Lives Matter movement, primarily through her video posts focused on police brutality. Controversy continues to rage over the circumstances of her arrest and the cause of her death, with some online bloggers claiming that Bland was actually murdered. Today, Mike and I want to honor her life and work as an activist and to take up some of the controversies around this case. So, Mike, let's start with her arrest, a scene that was recorded on the officer's dashboard camcorder. How do you read this scene?
Well, the real reason she was arrested is because of the financial superstructures in Texas, where there are no income taxes. Texas likes to brag about its low tax system. But as in Ferguson, Missouri, Waller County and Prairie View, Texas, are choking residents with court fees in order to fill their coffers in a state without income tax. You know, Debbie Nathan has been following this case for The Nation magazine and has burrowed into all the complicated web of fines and court costs that pile up with every time someone is arrested. And Sandra Bland was arrested after two exciting days, one a nonstop all-night drive from Chicago, the other a night of partying to celebrate her getting a new job. But she was arrested for failing to signal when changing lanes. And thanks to that video camera that was on, we know that the ultimate brutal arrest in which she was forcibly jerked around by Brian Insignia and then charged with a felony assault on an officer It didn't happen that way at all. And Encina himself is now facing perjury charges.
But you're saying that there, on one level, this was an officer who's doing his job and was kind of the functional arm of the state as well, both not in the sense of profiling necessarily, but there's a kind of banality of racism here.
Yeah, it's the systemic racism. It's not nearly as flamboyant or dramatic as execution of an unarmed child, but it is the rooting of monies out of the poorest people, which are overwhelmingly black and brown in Texas. He's a revenue collector. It was another day at work, and she did something that annoyed him, and he's got a very lordly feel to his job as revenue collector.
And the disciplinarian around that. And she had accumulated thousands of dollars in these kinds of fees over time. Is that correct? What's your sense of the history she brought to that dramatic moment of resistance on her part, as well as repression on his part?
Well, she had accumulated fines in Houston in particular, in Chicago. But part of the structure for raising money here is to make jails as unpleasant as possible. Nowhere are they really nice, but since it's possible for people to do a form of debtor's prison by sitting out fines at $100 a day in jail, jail is made so uncomfortable that people are more likely to be squeezed out of funds and actually give that money to the state. So she had before actually done time in jail on one of her traffic the violations in Houston, where she had a bit of alcohol in her blood, just a hair over the legal limit.
And so there was also this kind of cumulative harassment and dealing with the criminal justice system around this kind of struggle. And then I think it was also evident in the recording of that interaction with the officer, considerable resistance on her part. And I think that's always hard to portray. The tendency is to want to make her a kind of a saint, but she was not a saint. She was from all records available, a very dynamic person who kept trying to reach out and being constructively involved in the world. And also was both complying with what the officer demanded of her to do, but also resisting. And the question that emerges around that was she contributing in some way to her arrest by her behavior, and is her mental health status relevant to this? And many activists really reject the discussion of the her mental health as having any relevance, including in the questions about her death. So before we talk about the questions around her death, I'd like to play another clip from Sandra Bland where she talks about mental health issues and the importance of discussing them in the Black community.
It is March 1st, 2015. I want to first of all say I apologize. I am sorry, my kings and queens. It's been 2 long weeks and I have been missing in action. But I gotta be honest with you guys. I am suffering from something that some of you all may be dealing with right now. It's a little bit of depression as well as PTSD. I've been real stressed out over these past couple of weeks, but that does not excuse me not keeping my promise to you all by letting you know that somebody cares about you, someone loves you, and that you can go out there and do great things. But I want you guys to know that I'm a human. And so if there are any of you that are dealing with these same things, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's okay. It is okay to talk about it. I think that those illnesses are something that the African-American culture likes to turn a blind eye to and act like that they don't affect us. And they do. They really do.
Okay, that was Sandra Bland really calling for more discussion. And I think it cautions us about perhaps over-idealizing her in the context of her life and death and paying tribute to her. How we grant her a complex humanity and not require that she become a saint in order to make the case that the state is racist and oppressive.
Well, Jen, I don't think her mental health problems had much, if anything, to do with her arrest. She was ended up charged with being out of control and assaulting the felony officer, and the video makes clear none of that happened. I think it does weigh in very heavily in her jail time, because she told the jail when she first arrived that she had been depressed, that in fact she had actually tried to commit suicide because of a pregnancy gone wrong earlier within the previous year. Now, by the jail's own protocol, they should have either taken her to somebody and also done hourly checks on her to see how she was doing. They did none of that.
And that's beyond dispute. There's an acknowledgement on the part of the state that they did not follow protocol, and that she had registered these red flags about her history.
Well, they may dispute it in the course of a lawsuit, but actually her family has a very solid lawsuit, because civil rights cases are much easier to win when the state acknowledges that it violated its own protocol.
Well, what about this claim that's circulating quite a bit online, that she was not suicidal, the not wanting to prematurely conclude that she hadn't been murdered by the state as a representative and a loud voice in the Black Lives Matter movement. There's a role for an investigation, right? Around, and it was not an unreasonable suspicion early on.
Of course not. Yeah, you've got to investigate and look carefully, because whether or not it's neglect of the state's own policies or an active brute there within the jail who got annoyed or got pushed out of shape, these things need to be looked at closely. I think that in light of the circumstances of how her body was found and what she had been through and how she described herself, that suicide is certainly the most likely probability.
And I think it's often misunderstood in being reduced to either a willful, conscious, intentional act of the person and other people not being implicated, or someone is the assailant. And there, one could say that the state did kill her because of the whole circumstances of her life that sounds like did become very overwhelming at that point. And many suicides are impulsive and not necessarily thought out and are circumstantial, and that she was pretty isolated there and reaching out a lot. There were a lot of communications and trying to phone people. And so the cold unresponsiveness of the state can be as lethal in some cases as the use of a weapon.
Well, the whole systematic exploitation of poor people and young people in order to make up funding that a more reasonable state would get from people who actually earn significant amounts of money is a problem. She had no margin of error. She happened to be, in that moment, sleep-deprived, depressed, and unable to reach anyone. She felt very low. I think it is an impulsive thing, or it was an impulsive thing. Had things gone right, a little phone call, but that's the nature of the structure of our system is that she, being a Black woman too, is not going to be attended to with the same caution
or care. Yeah.
And so in a global or larger sense than the immediate brutal simplicity of a bullet, she was indeed a victim of racism and of systematic exploitation of poor people.
And a Black life that did not matter in that sense. And
that's
so
true.
I think the way we can keep her, continue to pay tribute to her life and work, is to keep the struggle of the Black Lives Matter movement going and be involved as allies. And her videos online are chillingly prescient, but also inspiring. She seemed like a lovely, passionate person and very thoughtful. And so hopefully her voice and work can carry on.
They're well worth watching.
Yeah. It's Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker paying tribute today to the life and work of Sandra Bland.
The pledge to resist We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our name.
That was Saul Williams and the DJ Spooky remix of Not In My Name, The Pledge of Resistance. Before that, we heard from Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discussing Black Lives Matter activist Sandra Bland. Thanks to them and to the other contributors to this Memorial Day episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM Portland. Desiree Helligers and her guest, peace activist and veteran Brian Wilson, Bill Resnick and creative nonviolence activist Brian Terrell, and our engineer, Joe Clement. Thanks also to our comrade, Clayton Morgridge, for his contributions to editing and posting the show. We'll be back next week. Stay tuned now for a special 10th anniversary broadcast of the Peabody Award-winning Asian American Pacific Islander radio history series, Crossing East.
Good morning. It is, a minute, 2.5 minutes before 10 a.m. And at 10 this morning, we are going to begin the broadcast of the all 8 hours of Dime Roberts' award-winning series, Crossing East, the first and to date only Asian American Pacific Islander history series on public radio. And we're all looking forward to that. Before we go into that, well, we have a couple minutes here, so let's hear a little Phil Oakes, Set the Morning Straight.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rise and smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, you've given me a number and you've taken off my name. To get around this campus, why, you almost need a plane. And you're supporting Chiang Kai-shek while I'm supporting Mao. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. I wish that you'd make up your mind, I wish that you'd decide, that I should live as freely as those who live outside. 'Cause we also are entitled to the rights to be endowed. And when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S. made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
And yes, you are tuned to KBOO Portland, and here comes Crossing East.
Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America.
Chinese ships were incredibly seaworthy, and it's not surprising that they survived all the way across the Pacific.
Coolie, the two characters, mean bitter strength.
But there are so many people up and down this coast that are of Hawaii.